Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Prisca Neely in for A. Martinez. Today, we talk to the folks behind a plan to transform a blighted section of the LA River into a wildlife habitat where you'll probably want to hang out. Plus, why the 50-year-old rockets on display at a museum in Downey are still relevant.
And the crazy thing is, a lot of this technology is now being used to design the next generation of rockets.
That's all ahead on Take Two.
Hi, this is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights. The screening Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown LA. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Prisca Neely in for A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Coming up later in the show, we'll visit the city of Downey to find out more about its role in the Apollo 11 mission. Plus, we'll chat with best-selling novelist Jasmine Guillory about writing romance novels that feature Black women living their best lives. But we start with the LA River. The city has unveiled three different plans for a mile-long park in the Taylor Yard area. The idea is that this blighted industrial stretch of the river would be restored as a wildlife habitat and also serve as a fun spot for people, too. Joining us now are two women fundamental to the plan. Deborah Weintraub is LA's chief deputy city engineer. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Mia Lehrer. She's the founder of the landscape architectural firm Studio MLA, which helped come up with the design plans. Welcome, Mia.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Deborah. Before we get into the proposed design, tell us a little bit more about the Taylor Yard area. Where is it along the river, and what does it look like now?
So the Taylor Yard area is a site between Cypress Park on the east side of the river and Elysian Valley on the west side of the river, and it's next to an existing park called Rio de Los Angeles State Park. It's a 42-acre piece of land that was a rail yard for over 100 years that the city purchased to create new open space.
And we've heard a lot over the years about this big master plan to revitalize the LA River. How does this Taylor Yard project fit into that larger plan?
So that fits in perfectly. There's a long history to this site and a focus on this site. The city did a river revitalization master plan in 2007 that I was very involved with that identified this as a real linchpin in terms of river revitalization and bringing the life of the river to the city and to the community. Following that revitalization master plan, we, the city, worked very closely with the Corps of Engineers to do a study that included this piece of land that was called the Arbor Study. And it also said this is a key site for habitat restoration and for a nature-focused open space.
So as you mentioned, this has been in the works for a long time. But as we get closer, we have these three plans. Mia, tell us about these three different landscape design scenarios for Taylor Yard. And let's start with the island concept. What would that look like?
So the idea with the island scheme was to actually bring, you know, right now the river has a series of small islands, if you're on a kayak or if you look down into the river's edge, which have really created this wonderful sort of series of habitat. It's a historic feature for, you know, the last hundreds of years to have these moments within the waterway. And so to celebrate that and to create an urban ecological feature, we create this island, and it's kind of this memorable sort of element in the design where you say, "Oh, let's go to the park."
Mm-hmm.
Have you been to the island? Have you gone over the bridge? you can see the whole river from that location.
I'm talking with Mia Lehr, founder of the landscape architectural firm Studio MLA. Also with us is Deborah Weintraub, LA's chief deputy city engineer. I want to talk a little bit in more detail about these other two scenarios for Taylor Yard. But first, Deborah, let's just zoom out a little bit and talk about what we're really hoping to achieve overall with this project.
So by adding this piece of open space along the river, we really, as Mia just so eloquently describes, we bring people to the river's edge in a whole different way than we have anywhere else on the river. And we start to integrate the nature, the flora and the fauna of the river into the city. And so what we're really hoping to achieve is a community and publicly accessible, nature-focused open space that allows for that kind of serene opportunity for the public in the heart of the city. So we're hoping to add to the existing parks in that area, to connect to them with a very nature-focused experience for the public.
That sounds really exciting, especially when you think about what the area is like now. So, okay, back to you, Mia. Let's talk about just briefly these two other design ideas. So we've got soft edge and the yards. Tell us about those.
The soft edge, what it does is a series of plateaus, you know, that sort of a series of deeper steps along the water's edge. So if you were to come down towards the water to sit along the edge, or to walk towards, because we will have kayak launches on the north and the south. We will have areas for fishing. We will have areas to restoration opportunities in these sort of widened stepped areas. So many different people can be along the water's edge having very different experiences. And it also provides, of course, more opportunity for the benefits of the habitat and the necessary areas to plant. The yards, we basically have a very large central feature, which is an enormous shade structure that has a lot of different functions. Aside from shade, you can get water, you can meet your friends, you can have all sorts of experiences that emanate from there into these walking, jogging, walking moments. And you're perched in certain areas over the river, and you're able to get to your kayak, you're able to go fishing, but you have a very different set of experiences that are perhaps in some ways maybe a little bit more urban, but in character.
That sounds great. All three of those design concepts sound like they would be really fun to attend and to spend time there. Deborah, this park at Taylor Yard isn't slated to be open until 2028, so we've got some time here. What steps need to happen before then?
The city has always intended to open the park in kind of different projects, so we'd like to bring people on the site much sooner than 2028. So our first project will be focused on bringing people to the river's edge and creating a water feature on the site. And that will take, we hope, 3 to 5 years to open. As you can imagine, with 42 acres, it's going to require a fair amount of money to do the entire project. So we're going to do it in separate projects and start to use the site as soon as possible. Doesn't mean we won't keep our eye on the ball for the whole thing being done in 10 years, but our goal is to bring people on in phases.
And between now and then, is there anything else in the works for the LA River to make it more user-friendly for people who live here now, you know, in these years before it's all together?
Well, from my perspective, working in the city in the Bureau of Engineering, we're working on quite a number of river-related projects. We're starting design work, which Mia is also involved with, to make the bike path along the river and the valley contiguous. We're building in the stretch through Elysian Valley 3 new pedestrian bridges crossing the river. The construction of the 6th Street Viaduct, which is something I'm also working on. We're completing plans to do a new 12-acre park below it. But Taylor Yard G2 has long been the apple of everyone's eyes. Like, this is the place where we can create a huge new open space that reinterprets the river for the residents of Los Angeles.
Deborah Weintraub is Chief Deputy City Engineer for the City of Los Angeles. We've also been speaking with Mia Lair, the founder of Studio MLA, which came up with three proposed design concepts for Taylor Yard, and that's part of the LA River Revitalization Project. Deborah, Mia, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As a surprise to some of you, but there's a coal plant in Utah that supplies around a quarter of LA's electricity. At least for now, it's set to close down in 2025 as California seeks to end its reliance on the dirtiest fuel sources. But a natural gas plant is supposed to take its place, and that plan isn't sitting too well with some of the groups who want the state to just rely on renewables, like solar. For more, we have Sammy Roth. He's a reporter for the LA Times, who writes about energy and the environment. Welcome to Take Two.
Happy to be here.
So I have to say that I was pretty surprised to know that we are powered by a coal plant in Utah.
Yeah, nobody knows that. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. So tell me more about this place, where it's located, and why is it there?
Yeah, you know, it was built in the middle of the 1980s. It was Los Angeles and five other cities in Southern California, Riverside, Anaheim, Pasadena, Burbank, and Glendale. It was really after the oil crisis in the 1970s that they all kind of got together and said, well, we know we can't be so reliant on oil anymore for electricity, which was big at the time, and we can't build a coal plant here in the L.A. Basin because the air pollution is too bad.
Mm.
So they got together and said, let's go build this thing in Utah. And they got some partners up there, and they put it up outside a town called Delta, which is about 2 hours south of Salt Lake City.
So they have some space there, I assume, too, that we don't here?
Yeah, big, wide-open landscape. They built a transmission line as well, 500 miles dedicated to this project, brings the electricity down to Southern California. It's, engineering-wise, it's a pretty impressive project.
Hmm. So this is set to close down in 2025, and the plan is to shift to a gas plant instead. Los Angeles is still a major player in that project, so tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, the city of Los Angeles, like everyone else in California, is trying to, you know, deal with these mandates to get to higher levels of renewable energy. The state has a goal of, 100% zero carbon electricity by 2045. LA is getting a lot more renewables, but they're also saying, well, we want to be able to keep the lights on reliably, and they're making the argument that they can't do that without building this natural gas plant to replace at least part of what they're losing with coal. You know, gas is a traditional fuel. You can burn it in a turbine. You can reliably generate around the clock, unlike with solar or wind, where you need battery storage to keep those sources going when the sun or the wind aren't there.
So what are LA officials saying about why the city is behind a gas plant? Because, you know, sure, it's cleaner than coal, but it's still a pollutant, and California has been such a big proponent of renewables.
Yeah, they've had sort of two really interesting arguments for why gas and why in this spot. One is that they have this power line, right, that goes from Utah to Southern California, and they do want to build a bunch of solar up in Utah and batteries and wind and bring that clean stuff over the power line. They say that for engineering reasons, they cannot operate that power line unless they also have a gas plant at the other end of it, firm power to sort of push stuff over the line. That's disputed by a lot of the experts that I talked to about this, but that's what they're claiming. The other thing is that they have these partners in Utah that actually own the power line and own the power project, and they basically say that the Utah people won't let them use the line unless they build a gas plant up there, because that's going to replace some of the jobs that are lost when the coal plant closes.
Hmm. But L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti said not too long ago that he plans to shut down remaining gas-powered plants along the coast because of his Green New Deal. So why is it okay to build a gas plant in Utah?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and something that a lot of environmentalists and clean energy advocates are raising. I mean, Garcetti has sort of taken this Green New Deal language, which is supposed to be about doing everything possible to address the climate crisis as quickly as possible, and to sort of take bold steps. He's shutting down these gas plants here in the basin. That was a decision he made earlier this year. That was really exciting for environmentalists who had been pushing for that. And meanwhile, sort of out of sight, out of mind, up in Utah, they're planning to build a new gas plant, and that's definitely something that I think is somewhat difficult to justify.
Yeah. So this gas plant is an $865 million investment.
Mm-hmm.
When will building start, and how long will it take?
So it's supposed to, they're supposed to start actually laying the gas pipelines to get the gas up there by the end of this year. So that's, January 1st is sort of their construction start deadline. And it's supposed to come online by 2025, which is when the coal plant closes. And, you know, one interesting comment on the timeline is California is moving, away from fossil fuels so quickly right now. Gas plants are, being shut down in some places, closing ahead of schedule. If this, does go forward and get built, it may very well be the last gas plant built to, to serve California coming on in 2025.
And just quickly, are there plans by LA to get behind more renewable energy projects as well?
Definitely. In fact, next week the LA DWP is supposed to approve a record low solar price contract for a solar project in the desert north of Los Angeles. But yes, and they're building, they want to do renewables up in Utah as well. And I've actually got a story coming on that topic, so stay tuned for that.
We shall stay tuned. Thanks so much. Sammy Roth is the energy and environment reporter for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a visit to the Columbia Memorial Space Center in Downey. That's where a NASA site where all of the Apollo spacecraft that took astronauts to the moon were created. We'll take a trip there, plus a chat with one of the unsung heroes of the mission. Stay tuned. It's coming up here on Take Two. Back now with more Take Two. I'm Prisca Neely in for A. Martinez. This week, you've been hearing lots of stories about the Apollo 11 mission, which landed on the moon 50 years ago. As part of our coverage looking at Southern California's role in the Apollo program, KPCC reporter Josie Wong went to the city of Downey to learn why it was formerly known as Spacetown, USA.
Those are sounds from the ceremonial launch earlier this week, marking the 50th anniversary of the Saturn V rocket. Students from schools in the South Bay were participating in all kinds of activities at the Columbia Memorial Space Center in Downey to celebrate the Apollo 11 mission. We asked kids at the celebration why they might want to venture into space.
Because I want to see the Earth.
Oh yeah, you must get a really good view of the Earth from standing atop the moon, huh?
Yes.
Do you think you'd like to be an astronaut?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because astronauts, they have their footprints there still.
Oh, you want to go see their footprints?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that they were still there. That would be pretty cool to see.
That was Ewan Garcia, a third grader from Jacobson Elementary, and Jacob Orozco, a fourth grader from McNair Elementary, who shared their dreams of space exploration. They were at Columbia Memorial this week. Ben Dicko is the president and executive director there and gave me a tour of the museum, highlighting the important role the city of Downey once played in the space race.
Ben, when people think of space missions, they don't usually think of Downey necessarily these days, right? But yep. Downey, as you well know, was an integral part of the Apollo 11 mission. This is where the command module, which is, I understand, the mothership, so to speak, was built. So how did Downey become part of space history?
Well, Downey's been a part of space history since the beginning. We built airplanes here up and through World War II, huge amount of airplanes. So right after the war, North American Aviation got really interested in rockets, so we started rocket research, and from there it kind of cascaded until November of 1961, North American got the contract for the Apollo spacecraft. So that's the command service module, the launch escape tower, second stage of the Saturn V, like the whole shebang, basically.
So where we're standing now, where the center is situated, is this the campus where the module was actually built?
So that building, the 24-hour fitness right there, was building 290. That was a huge building that was the final assembly building for where all the capsules came off the assembly line. This place was, I think, almost two times as large as Disneyland at the time. And 35,000 people worked here in the 60s on this program.
So before all these folks came to Downey, what was Downey like? I mean, did the space industry make Downey?
In a way, I think Downey was a city for a long time, and there's a lot of dairy farms around here and a lot of orchards. So it's been, aerospace or aeronautics has been pretty much a part of Downey's history since, you know, at least almost 100 years, maybe 90 years. But there was other industries. But definitely once the real space race started, this became Spacetown USA. We were really fortunate. Aerojet Rocketdyne, who actually started here too, funded an exhibit that's basically about Spacetown USA, all about the Apollo 11 and how it transformed the place.
Ben, should we go see that?
Sure, let's do it.
Come on. Let's do it. Well, Ben, you've stopped off in front of, is this an engine or
this
a rocket?
So I'm really, really fortunate that we were able to get these two engines here. This is a J2 engine. This was on the Saturn V rocket 50 years ago that launched today.
I'm going to stop you really quick. Yeah. The Saturn V rocket, is that what launched the Apollo 11 into space?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so okay. The Saturn V rocket, the most powerful rocket we've ever built, 361 feet high. These engines were in the second and fourth stage, and they kicked the space capsule towards the moon. This engine is even more connected to this site because this is the service module engine. So we built the command and service module, and that bell at the bottom is this engine without the bell. This is the engine that the only one rated for like interstellar travel because it was fired in space out of Earth's orbit, and it fired to get us to the moon in orbit and then fired to get us back to Earth. This is a 50-plus-year-old piece of technology. And the crazy thing is a lot of this technology is now being used to design the next generation of rockets because technology's changed, but, you know, physics doesn't change very much. So if we keep walking here,
we've walked over to this glass exhibit with a lot of cool-looking smaller items, but tell us what we see.
So this, we've tried to put together a very brief sort of overview of the Apollo program, starting with Kennedy's speech in 1961. This is a model from back in the 60s of the command and service module and the launch escape. This was the prime thing that was built, designed and built here. The Apollo 1 disaster was actually a really important thing for this site in particular. So Apollo 1, the first Apollo capsule to have a crewed test, right?
Can you just give a little bit more detail about how the mission failed?
So three astronauts, Gus Grissom, who is the second American in space, Ed White, who is the first American to walk in space, and Roger Chaffee, this would have been his very first mission. They were set to be the first crew of Apollo, so Apollo 1. And they were in Florida. They were doing an all-stack test, so basically the whole thing. But they were going to launch a few weeks later, but they were going to do just an electrical test. So they all get in the cabin. It's done exactly like a launch. So they seal them up in the capsule. Sometime during the test, there's a spark from a faulty wire in the capsule. And it was, at that time, it was a highly pressurized, all-oxygen environment. So within less than 90 seconds, they were incinerated, basically. So there were people from Downey there that day, because we were the manufacturers, who had to get in and see what happened. When they finally took it all apart, they saw that there was, because of the strong deadline to get it done by the end of the 60s, there were corners being cut, people weren't talking to each other. It changed the entire sort of communication system of NASA, and it radically changed what happened here. So when this failed with the first crew, the engineers and the people who worked here really took it personally. A lot of them talk about and still get a little emotional about this whole time period here. But it's amazing that everybody got together in less than 18 months in October of 68. So this is January of 67. October of 68, they launch Apollo 7, which is the first crewed Apollo capsule. So they radically redesigned it in less than, basically in about a year. It's amazing.
So it sounds like the Apollo 1 tragedy galvanized
Absolutely.
The people working on the shuttle making.
You're right. It did galvanize the program and got everybody refocused again to total quality management.
What else are we seeing?
And this is, it's an unassuming thing, but it to me is the most precious item of, maybe in our collection, but definitely of this exhibition. That flag was on the moon.
That tiny little thing. It's no more than a few inches. Like a 5x7?
Yeah,
a little
maybe.
Bigger than that?
Yeah. This was taken up on actually the last moon mission, Apollo 17, and then brought back down and given to key employees of the site as gifts for their work on the mission.
So, you know, today there's very little trace of this massive operation of 35,000 people working here. And, you know, aside from the center that you run, what happened to the space industry of Downey?
Well, not just of Downey, of all of Southern California. Pretty much when the Cold War ended, you know, we cut back on a lot of that stuff. So basically the U.S. sort of changed its priorities and looked at something else. So all that left in the 90s,
it's incredible that when it went away, you really saw the impact that it had. I mean, aerospace just made Southern California in the mid-century. But it's fascinating to be here to think about how these towns and others have had to reinvent themselves.
We've been speaking with Ben Dicko, President and Executive Director of the Columbia Memorial Space Center here in Downey. Thanks so much for this tour.
Oh, you got it. Thank you
awesome.
So much for being here and celebrating with us.
Earlier this year, the Columbia Memorial Space Center featured an exhibit dedicated to the career of our next guest, Shelby Jacobs. He's now retired, but Jacobs worked on the shuttle program for over 40 years as an engineer, including work on the Saturn V rocket used to go to the moon. As an African American, his experiences reflect the complicated but inspiring history of space exploration in the United States. Mr. Jacobs, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure.
So because of your work developing camera systems for NASA, we have these dazzling photographs from the Apollo 6 mission, which captured the first images of Earth from space. I wondered, you know, did you know how special these images were at the time? Did you think we'd be talking about them all these years later?
No, I did not. It was a routine task and one of many hundreds of tasks I had over 40 years that has exceeded my expectations and become iconic. And I've had to refer back to it because I went on to do what I consider to be bigger and better things. But film from the camera has created a life of its own.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those bigger things, because that was really early in your career. Can you tell us about some of the other projects you contributed to, like the Saturn V rocket?
My first experiences was I worked at Rocketdyne on the engines that flew on the Saturn. I transferred to Downey to work on the Saturn vehicle itself because of my rocket experience. The camera system was just a sideline of what I worked on, and I worked on hardware on the entire aerospace program, all of the Apollos, not just Apollo 11, but all of them.
Well, it's good that you're able to share some other parts of your story. When we think about the moon landing, how vividly do you remember that, and you know, what moments really stayed with you?
Like most people, it was a pinnacle of what was an opportunity for me to make a difference out of the backdrop that I was told that I couldn't be an engineer because of being black. Mm. My high school principal told me that in 1953, so 69 was the ultimate evidence to the contrary.
Yeah. And what were some of the other moments of discrimination that you faced as a black man in this vastly white industry? How did you deal with those moments?
Well, I dealt with it very well because I recognized that every job I had from my entire 40 years, I was literally taking a seat which would obviously be preoccupied by a white. So I was a source of that kind of envy because I, by definition, I was doing something that was defined as not something that blacks could or would do. So the backdrop to my career was there was a tendency to underestimate my ability, which gave me an opportunity to excel because they had set a low standard. And so I was able to command a lot of attention because I outperformed any of their expectations for 40 years in a row.
And what's it like to gain recognition in these recent years, you know, for all of this work that you did over a very long career, but some of it a really long time ago? How does that feel?
It feels great, but it's been a progression over the years. It's been more and more. The 40th anniversary 10 years ago, I got some. This being the 50th, I'm getting more, a lot more. So it's been a progression of recognition, not just this one period of time.
Well, in the decades following the Apollo 11 mission, do you think that the relationship between the American public and space exploration has changed?
The fact that we're not in a race causes us not to be able to generate the energy required to succeed in the same basis as we did on the Apollo program. The merits of our experience, the fact that I'm interviewing with you on an iPhone, which probably wouldn't have existed for another 20 years, that was accelerated by the space program. And so I'm thinking that society in general, if we get back to exploring space and our contribution, how it affects us, it will enhance our entire life. And we should be able to pursue space based on its merits.
Mm. Well,
For our listeners, you know, kind of in that vein of exploration and advancement, you know, we have some people in our audience who grew up watching the shuttle program. I wonder if you have any advice for young children of color in particular who may be interested in careers in space, in the space field.
But I advise them, based on my own experience, that they have now and they can tap into role models which didn't exist for us. So the fact that you can Google and find Blacks who participated in many areas of life all the way to the White House, that is an advantage that they should be delighted to know, and they can tap into that, and so anything is possible. Whereas in my case, it was a blind faith without evidence that it could happen.
That's Shelby Jacobs, a retired engineer from the Apollo space program, talking with us about the 50th anniversary of the moon landing and so much more. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
My pleasure.
Now, if you remember the Apollo 11 mission and watching the moon landing, we want to hear from you. Share your memories by leaving Take Two a message. Please call us at 626-583-5281. That's 626-583-5281. We'd love to hear from you. And coming up, something to keep in mind if you're ever out for a hike and hear a snap or something alarming in the bushes, you may try to reassure yourself with the thought that whatever animal it is probably more afraid of you than you are of it. We've got some research to back that up coming up next on Take Two.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Priska Neely in for A. Martinez.
Into the woods without delay, but careful not to lose the way. Into the woods, who knows what may be lurking on the journey.
Imagine that you're a scary mountain lion prowling the California wilderness. Few things strike fear in your furry heart. But then, off in the distance, there's the faint sound of probably one of the worst things a cougar can hear.
At the higher end of the circular valley, a river fell off the cliffs, where it hurried discreetly through with no
That's
rapids,
the voice no of a human, but not just any human.
Hi, my name is Justin Sarasi. I am a postdoctoral scholar in the Environmental Studies Department at UC Santa Cruz.
That means he's a wildlife ecologist and researcher. And for his latest study, he set up audio speakers in the California wilderness. Some played recordings of him and others reading from random books and poems. Stuff he liked, not, say, audio recordings from Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
So we wanted something that wouldn't be too horrible to be subjected to, you know, out there in the field.
Other times, those speakers would play something more natural, like this. What he found is one of those things you might whisper to yourself if you're ever out hiking, afraid some hungry mountain lion is going to pounce on you. Most animals really are more afraid of you than you are of them.
Mountain lions will go out of their way to avoid an interaction with people.
Sarasi's team tracked cougars with radio collars and was able to map out just how much cougars tried to get away from those human noises.
They sort of avoid each individual speaker. They're trying to like pass through in a way where they can stay as far as possible from any sound source.
Those human recordings also affected how lesser predators like bobcats, skunks, and possums moved around.
Sort of hiding more, moving around less, presumably to avoid a potentially risky interaction with people.
But then Justin Sarasi came across a surprising discovery that quite literally, while the cat's away, the mice will play.
We were tracking the movements of deer mice and wood rats. And what we found is that these smaller species are increasing their space use and increasing their foraging behavior during our human treatments.
Based on his research, he came to this conclusion. There might be an environmental impact from Californians enjoying the outdoors or building homes in rural areas. But also, humans can have a huge impact on ecosystems just by opening their mouths.
Layered on top of all these other human impacts is just the fear that we instill in wildlife.
It's something to think about the next time you go for a hike or camp or spend the weekend at a rustic cabin out in the woods. And if you're still afraid that a mountain lion might be lurking behind a tree, we'll help you out. Got a recorder ready? Okay, just play this while you're on the trail. Hey there, Mr. Mountain Lion. This is KPCC's Priska Neely. You'd better be afraid of me and leave this hiker alone. Otherwise, I'm going to start a pledge drive. And you don't want that, do you? Mr. Mountain Lion, you are our biggest, most reliable source of funding. Please pick up those paws of yours right now and call 866-8. Here's the sound of something a little more comforting for fans of comics, superhero movies, and more. San Diego Comic-Con starts today. The event draws around 160,000 people, and when Angelenos go, some skip the car and take the train. Amtrak's Pacific Surfliner runs from downtown LA and drops off just blocks from all the action in San Diego. The train is so popular during Comic-Con that ridership goes up 40% over average. I can attest to this. I once had to stand on a train for 2 hours on the way down during Comic-Con weekend. So to address this, Amtrak is increasing service by creating an additional 9,500 seats on the line between now and Sunday. For a lucky few, they might hear someone who's a regular feature on the Pacific Surfliner. So let's introduce him. Anthony Bryant serves food, drinks, and songs from the cafe car.
Southbound Amtrak service, making stops at Fullerton and LA.
It's a beautiful and sunny Saturday morning. For a train ride.
My name is Anthony Bryant, and I'm the cafe guy on board the Amtrak Pacific Surfliner. I'm basically the provider of quality food and beverage to the customers.
But then again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
The PA! The PA lets me communicate with everyone on the train.
It's a beautiful day for a train ride.
Yay!
Thank you.
My number one fan.
Maybe this song, a lot of people tell me, they said, oh, only reason I came down was because of the song.
You
enjoy it.
What a wonderful voice you have.
Oh, well, thank you, young lady. Thank you very much. Thank you very
young
much.
Young lady.
Whoa. Young and hard, right?
Yeah, my name is Jeanette St. John, and big fan of Anthony.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank
He's
very
the
much.
Man. He is the man.
Where are you going today? Where are you going?
See you.
Oh.
I've been there
two times already? I've been out here a total of 23 years.
The wines are 15 a bottle, yeah.
I've been singing for about 17.
Have you ever tried out for the opera?
They shut me down for a couple years. I couldn't play music or sing. Someone from D.C. came back, a spotter, and said, we don't want you to sing bureaucratic stuff.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Maybe a nice letter or something came in, or maybe ideologies change a little bit. I've been pretty good seeing these 3 years now.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
We are now arriving San Clemente Pier.
And leaving San Clemente, I'm going to do the California song today. Yes, I don't know if you've ever heard that.
That's the official California state song written in 1913 by FBC. I love you, California, you're the greatest state of all. I love you in the winter, summer, spring, and in the fall.
I love your
They call it the Pacific Surfliner because of the scenery we go by.
I love her grand ocean and I love her rugged shores.
We get the surf, we get the ocean. At San Clemente, you can get off the train and you're in the sand. Bring your surfboard with you.
By the sea, every breeze bearing rich perfume. It is here.
I'm from the city of brotherly love. I used to always take the trains back and forth between like Philly and New York and Baltimore. Back east, everything is urban. Decay and graffiti, you know.
I love your redwood forest.
I can't imagine too many more places as scenic as this line is. Every day it blows me away. This is my utopia.
Land of honey, fruit, and wine. I love your old great missions. Love your vine land stretching far.
We look forward to seeing you very, very soon on one of our fine scenic train routes.
I love you, California. I just can't help loving you. All right. Thank you. Got it in.
That's Anthony Bryant, who sometimes runs the cafe car on Amtrak's Pacific Surfliner route. KPCC's Leo Duran produced that story, and you can see a video of Anthony and the oceanside view from the train on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/take2show. Coming up, a chat with romance novelist Jasmine Guillory. Stay tuned for our conversation here on Take Two.
And I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one. And I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of dawn.
You're listening to Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Prisca Neely in for A. Martinez. Jasmine Guillory is already a New York Times best-selling author. She's written two romance novels, The Proposal and The Wedding Date. And this week, she's back with another called The Wedding Party. This is a tale of enemies who become lovers, and it's a lot of fun. The book has only been out for a few days, but it's already getting rave reviews from the likes of some pretty famous ladies, from Oprah to Shonda Rhimes. Guillory lives in Oakland, but she's in LA as part of her book tour and joins us in studio. Jasmine, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into the specifics of The Wedding Party, I just want to step back and talk about romance novels. This is your third, and you know, I feel like there are a lot of assumptions about this genre. For those who don't read it, can you kind of give a quick pitch? Like, what do you love about romance novels?
You know, the thing I love about romance is that romance novels take women and our lives and our desires seriously, which is a thing that I think a lot of the world doesn't. I mean, not just books, like, yeah, most of the world doesn't. You know, I think there a lot of people kind of make fun of romance novels in the exact same way they make fun of other things that women like.
So for The Wedding Party, we've got three main characters, Maddie, Theo, and Alexa. Obviously don't want to give away too many details, but how would you lay out the relationship between those characters?
Well, Alexa is the main character from my first book, The Wedding Date. Maddie and Theo are two of her best friends. And in this book, Alexa is getting married. Maddie and Theo are both in the wedding. They have never liked each other, and now they're thrown together a lot, and lots of sparks fly.
And so we've got, you know, The Proposal, The Wedding Date, all of these stories that revolve around people getting married. I'm not married myself, but I've been to a lot of weddings, been in a lot of weddings. What is it about that occasion? Why are you setting so many of your books in weddings?
You know, I have also been to and in a lot of weddings. And I find weddings fascinating because there's just so much emotion around weddings. Like, they're, you know, I think it's one of the few times where you invite everyone in your life, from like from people from elementary school to work friends to college friends to grad school friends to your family, all in the same place. Everything gets heightened for, you know, everyone involved. And then also for people attending the wedding, it also feels like there's something big, there's something at stake here. Mm-hmm. You know, I've known a lot of people who've like had romances at weddings, who've met people at weddings, or who've also had big fights and broken up at weddings.
Yeah.
So,
all sorts of drama.
All sorts of drama. So it is, it's been very interesting to kind of mine that for fiction.
As I said, I've been in a lot of weddings and people act really different.
Yes, they really do.
I've just watched some of my friends become like crazy versions of themselves.
Yes.
I'm talking with Jasmine Guillory, author of the new romance novel, The Wedding Party. You, am I right, graduated from Stanford Law School? And
yes.
Before romance, you were doing YA. So how did we get here?
You know, I started reading a lot of romance. And about 6 years ago, I was going through a really difficult time in my life. I had a really scary health crisis. And I threw myself into reading romance novels. And I discovered that they are a very soothing thing to read when difficult things are going on. Because, you know, going into the book, you know, nothing terrible is going to happen. If there's a dog that we meet in this book, the dog is not going to die. If there's a baby, the baby is not going to have a health crisis. You know, like all of those things were really, were like really comforting for me. But then I also learned there's so much more to romance novels than like people say that there are. You know, people go through a lot of difficult things. They learn about each other and themselves. There's a lot about family, friendships, jobs, and it like I started to really care so much about these books and started thinking, I wonder if I could do this. And then I tried.
Wow. You know, you mentioned that kind of escapist nature of the romance world. And it's interesting because, you know, you're a Black woman who puts Black women at the center of the stories that you write, of these worlds that you create. And for myself, I even think about this in my own work, because for the last more than a year, I've been doing a lot of stories about maternal deaths, for the high rates for Black women, also Black infant mortality, like these really heavy topics that are real. You know, it's a real part of life for Black people. But, you know, I have to say that it's really refreshing to see characters who are just living and loving and, you know, just being themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, particularly over the past few years when life as a Black woman has felt very heavy in America. Not to say that for the past 200 years, sure, life is about Black women, you know, yes. But like these past few years have been particularly hard. And it has been good for me to read and to write books about Black women thriving. And I think, you know, it is not to say that we ignore what is going on in the world in these books. And I certainly, you know, the people in them have conversations about race and how that affects them on their daily lives. I like to read books where people are going out there and living their lives and succeeding in the way that I see Black women doing it. You know, it is not, even though life as a Black woman has felt difficult and heavy, there are lots of Black women out there thriving and doing great. And I want to celebrate them in real life and in fiction.
Yeah. You wrote this essay for Oprah Magazine after your second book, The Proposal, came out. I really, really loved this essay because you talk about, you know, creating the characters that you want to see. Like if popular portrayals of Black women in media are showing something else, you did that. Like you filled the space.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there are so many great stories about Black women out there. And, you know, I mean, Becoming has been one of the best selling books of all time. Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah,
that,
Michelle Obama's book.
Yes. And I love that book. And I want to encourage other Black women out there who don't think that people want to hear their story, don't think that people want to read about them, to put, you know, to put their stories out there, too.
Is there a story that you're itching to tell? Anything that you can talk about?
Well, you know, what's interesting, I have another book coming out in October, and that story is about a Black woman in her 50s who falls in love. And that was one thing that I wasn't sure if people would want that, because a lot of, you know, so many romance novels are about people in their 20s and 30s.
Right.
I had an event last night, and there were some Black women in their 50s there who were like, yes, we want that book. So that, you know, I was delighted to be able to tell that story, and I hope people love it. It's called Royal Holiday.
Well, as we mentioned, there's been some attention from Hollywood around your books. And earlier this year, Reese Witherspoon added your last novel, The Proposal, to her book club. She has a production company. Should we be expecting any movies in the works?
You know, I mean, keep your fingers crossed. I think it is always wonderful to dream about that. But but my goal is always just to tell the next story and to do what I can to put my stories out there in the world and to help other people who may not know how to do any of this put their stories out in the world, too.
Jasmine Guillory, author most recently of The Wedding Party. She'll be in conversation tonight with Sonali Dev at The Ripped Bodice in Culver City. Jasmine, it's really been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
And that's all for Take Two on this Thursday. It was great to be here with you again. If you missed any part of the show, you can listen wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow us on Twitter at Take Two. I'm Priska Neely, and you can follow me on Twitter at Priska Neely. Have a great day, and thanks for trusting us with your time.